We get the hour underway, though, by welcoming into the program talented writer and friend of the show, Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
What is up, Mr. Kimball?
Just doing what we do here, you know, making our way through the afternoon. You were back to being a Zulu warrior, as it appears, over the weekend.
That remark suggests that I somehow stopped being a Zulu warrior.
Well, no, that's of course not.
You can't put that past a true Zulu. Come on, man. Yes. I don't know. Zulu-wise, which day did you prefer? Now, I know, like, Sunday was a special, especially Zulu-y with the 23 miles walk.
That was the one I was thinking of, but also doing hills in the rain. The cold rain.
Oh, it wasn't rain. It was nautical. It was a gale with January thunder, and I'm someone who wakes up and sees this and thinks, you know what? It's a good proving day. Let's see how we rate, how we're doing. And it was one of those mornings where the cars aren't even out. It's like, let's just stay in the garage, boys. And there I was going up. It wasn't even a hill at that point. It was just this pile of liquid mud to me.
Well, that's how one becomes and reestablishes themselves as a Zulu warrior.
Yeah, well, I feel like a guy like you, come to Boston sometime. We'll do some hill sprints. I'm getting better at the hill sprints, so feeling a little bit better about myself. But, Kimball, Fleming, up a hill, up some stairs. Come on, we could film that. We'd go viral on YouTube.
I'll let you set the pace on that one, but I'll keep up for about 10 minutes anyway.
I believe in you, sir, even if you don't.
Thank you. I mean, it's good to have somebody on the team here. A lot to talk about. My goodness. Let's start with this wonderful piece of fiction in London magazine, It Was Night, the story of a less than expected sibling relationship.
It is. I think that's a good way of putting it. It was a story that it's not long word count wise, and it was one of the first stories I wrote for what is become for a long time now. You've seen so many of these, this project called Longer on the Inside, very short fictions of infinitely human lives. And what I wanted to do was kind of change the nature of writerly physics, where you would have these stories that felt novelistic, and yet they'd be 800 words long, which doesn't seem like something you could do. It wouldn't be able to be possible to do something like that. You'd have a scene or a vignette, and that's not at all what this story is. It's in no means a scene or just the kind of like snippet of a life. It has that beginning, middle, end, that roundedness. And it's about a brother's guilt, I would say, for what he's done in one regard, what he feels he's done in another regard, to his brother, who is not in his life later when he has an especial need for him and his counsel, the kind of counsel that only a brother probably could give.
We've talked about this with you before, Colin. How is it? What is the key for you in helping give us these very well-developed characters in a minimal word count? It seems like that would be an incredible challenge.
I can't really think of another example of it either. It's not something that I would have been able to do 3-4 years ago. It was part of a maturation process. It was part of an evolution. I think something that you have to do is you have to have characters who exist in multiple temporal planes at once. And that's what's going to cleave away any vignette nature. But you have to be able to transition from this nowness to maybe 10 years before, within a syllable, within a single aptly chosen verb. And you also have to extend into a future that hasn't occurred yet. So you have to have like this multi-temporality, that a lot of that's going to come down to the word choice. It's also going to come down to this idea that you have to have characters that are more real than the people one knows in one's life. That when you go to bed at night, after you've read a story like this, you're wondering what's going on with these people out there. Mm. If it's like their time zone, like are they in bed right now like you are? That's how real that they have to be. And for characters to be that real, you have to know them yourself as the author in such a way that as soon as you say anything about them from the first clause, they have that multidimensionality. More so than like your own parents or your own kids or whatever it is. It's that immediate dimensionality that's just the crux of something like this.
And as always seems to happen in your writing, there's a phrase uttered by a character that I keep going back to and can't get out of my head. And in this story, it's, she said, we love people for the people we see in them.
Yes, and I know someone who had said to me, I know what they meant, but it wasn't quite accurate. They said, you go along in your fiction, and there will be these aphoristic moments, these aphoristic lines. And that's not really accurate, because to me, an aphoristic line is like a pull quote. It's almost like a bit from Aesop's Fables, like jammed into something, and has to come out in the natural dialogue, the natural narrative, the natural flow of things. And you get, I wrote about this on the blog earlier today, I think really what it ultimately comes down to, and this is what I don't see in fiction anywhere, is wisdom. And wisdom is very different than intelligence. Now, you can't have wisdom without intelligence, but you can be intelligent without wisdom. And I think wisdom is something where we're using a way to see the world in a way that people don't, from a different kind of ledge, in a way that helps people better look after themselves, grow better. And no matter what happens to the person who's dispensing the wisdom or whatever fear or blowback they might be experiencing, that wisdom is sacrosanct. They are always going to try to reach people with it, not in a preachy way, but in a way of a kind of gentle, guiding, loving humanness. And I think that's something that you get with a line of that nature.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Nobody else out there is writing incredibly impactful short fiction, getting that published in the same week that they do a really insightful piece on a new Billie Holiday documentary, but that's just what you've done in Jazz Times. And the narrative always seems to be the same about Billie Holiday, that somehow she's sort of a powerless victim of her own life's choices.
Exactly. And she's been railroaded in the film noir sense into this cartooning of an image. And I'll see, and you experience this too, I'm sure, examples of Billie Holiday pressed into service for various causes by people who've never listened to Billie Holiday. I see all of these women on dating sites, for instance, and I wrote about this in a pitch I had sent to someone for a Billie Holiday book. You'll see Billie Holiday spelled like Billie, like the man's name. And I take one for the team, and I try to like correct these people. Like, if you're going to pretend to like Billie Holiday, you should probably spell her name correctly. And I don't put it that way, because that would invite confrontation. But I do bring it up, and then I, of course, I get back the whole, "Are you mansplained to me?" It's like, just, your whole life doesn't have to be opposed. But that is the idea with Billie Holiday. She had the star-crossed life, and I think she's any person's idea of the tragic jazz artist, probably more so than anyone else. Like, Van Gogh is the tragic painter, and Billie Holiday fits that bill for popular singers. But it's not really true. And if you go through her different label stops along the way, she's so different at Commodore, she's so different at Verve, she's so different at Columbia, and she's so different at Decca, that you see this person who is deeply enmeshed in a journey, a development, a progression, and who as an artist is absolutely commanding her own material, her own legacy, her own depth of art.
So did this film do a good job of capturing the real Billie Holiday, or is it mostly about the mythical Billie?
I'd say that it did a good job, because what it does in part is now it sounds a little macabre, it rounds up the people who were there before they die to get them on record in a definitive sort of way. And I think he's really lax as a writer, but that was sort of Mark Lewison's undertaking with the big Beatles biography that he's doing. I find the prose unreadable, but he wanted to speak to a lot of people before they left this earth. So you have that going on. Now, you also have people who, and you can tell who they are as you watch, they're relishing in the clearly tall tales they're giving you. But you can also discern enough truth, and you get this composite. One person says this, one person says another, and you start like Johnny Dollar style to piece things together, so you do get this accurate biographical presentation of this person. But ultimately what you go back to is the life is in the art, and I don't mean it's autobiography, but the essence of the soul of the person behind all of that is in the art. And we've talked about this before, like you die at 44 if you're Billie Holiday. But it's deathless art. Billie Holiday is as much alive now as she was in 1952.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. We move from Billie Holiday to one of the great garage bands of all time from the 1960s, the Trogs, who are much more than Wild Thing, for goodness sakes.
They are. Wild Thing came out in 1966, so we have a bit of an anniversary there. But I was thinking about this today. If you took With Nail and I, the film, and made it into the form of a band, you'd come up with the Trogs. Because the Trogs are completely lascivious. They're disgusting in many ways. But then they'll put, like, a cello on the song. So you have this very Baroque, arty feel at times, but just for sheer sonic pornography, there's nothing to touch the Trogs. I listened to them today. It's like anytime you get the word, like, C-O-M-E in a Trog song, pretty much assume the alternative spelling. It's never like, you want to come over tonight? You want to come over tonight? Like, it's always that. And Wild Thing itself is like a song that is so ubiquitous that it is almost never spoken of. I've noticed that for many years, ever since I got into rock and roll, I've thought about that. People, it's like, to me, the rock and roll song of the 1960s. And as I get better at hearing things as I go along, I've noticed that what makes that song more than anything is the rhythm guitar. The entire song is that rhythm guitar, and it's very basic chording, but no one had ever played a rhythm guitar like that. And it's the lead instrument of the song, more than the voice. There's no lead guitar solo. It's that rhythm guitar that just redefined that bedrock, and later AC/DC, they're going to build their entire career around that idea of the rhythm guitar.
Well, and they were certainly an inspiration to people like Iggy Pop and to much of the punk movement.
They were, which makes it sound, and I know what you like, Mr. Bread and Air Supply, that they weren't tuneful, but they were highly tuneful, much more tuneful than, and I think the Stooges were quite tuneful too. It just comes with a hard rock edge. But in their hearts, I feel like the Trogs were pop singers and balladeers even. If you listen to their BBC sessions, they do a cover of Peggy Sue by Buddy Holly. And they're clearly just infatuated with Buddy Holly, which you might not expect, but they're doing that Lubbock accent and everything. Reg Presley is trying to come across like he's in a Buddy Holly cover band. And it's even quite touching. And then you have a song like Love Is All Around. And speaking of aphorism, it has this line in it, my mind's made up by the way that I feel. And it's just like, it sounds like in a sense that it's going to be like, oh, whatever I feel is how it goes. But when you think about the line, what you can do, that's not really what it means at all. It means in the end, having weighed everything rationally and thought it through, it ultimately comes down to this idea of an emotional mind being the what's going to motivate the final decision and tip those particular scales. And it's Pascal-like. It's really quite brilliant.
If people want to learn more about the Trogs, is there one album that you would suggest?
There isn't, because it's quite cool. It's like the Hollies. Like the Hollies and the Trogs are, and also big Buddy Holly fans with their name, clearly. But they had all of these great albums like Evolution and Butterfly, the Hollies in the 1960s. The Trogs had a decade chock full of great like albums too, and like kind of concept albums as well. So you can't go wrong. You can't go wrong with the singles package. I have been listening today to their BBC sides, and it's about like a 90-minute. You can listen to it on Amazon Music, or you can buy the compact disc. And I just think they do this version of Wild Thing, and they're talking to Brian Matthews, who introduced so many of those Beatles sessions. And Brian Matthews has clearly learned about the Trogs like 4 minutes before they came on, like someone handed them a note card. And they play a version of Wild Thing, and it sounds like the Beau Brummels. It doesn't sound like the Trogs at all. It's like angelic. It's like a Stone Roses demo from 1987. So it's a pretty cool one to check out.
All right, let's move from there to the world of basketball and one of my favorite teams, the 1980-81 Boston Celtics, coached by the underappreciated Bill Fitch and the emergence of the original Big Three.
Yep, you get Robert Parrish coming to the team that year, and Larry Bird is going to, I think he really cemented his 80s, or at least the first half of the 80s, dominance at that point. And it was like a period of transition, right? Because you had holdovers from the 70s teams, and you had this nascent power in the East really beginning their rise. And you have Kevin McHale becoming what he's going to be as a sixth man. I was thinking about this. Did the 1980s Celtics, now they win the championship this year, right, in 80-81. Do they underachieve in the decade of the 80s?
Well, you know, it's funny. You could make a case for that, certainly, given the talent they had.
Because they think, when you think of like a generational all-time team, I don't mean a single-season team, because you don't really have single-season teams in the NHL and in the NBA. Single-season teams are more the stuff of baseball after the Yankees dynasty and of football, if we just count like the Patriots. And a few teams had runs, but the 85 Bears, right? Like a classic single-season team, the 87 Twins type of thing. And the Bruins in the 1970s, I think we agree, both, they really underachieved. You shouldn't have just had two titles. And I think about that Celtics team, and I don't know, misconceptions. And I was watching some Larry Bird highlights, and with Bird, you always like, he's like Gretzky. There are always these strange arguments that he wasn't athletic, like Gretzky wasn't athletic, like passing's not athletic. Blows my mind that anyone could have ever watched Larry Bird, and I watched him beginning as a kid, and think that this was not some like paragon of athleticism. The thing that I saw him do, which I've never seen anyone do in all the years since, is he had the most percussive relationship with the basketball I've ever seen. By which I mean, he'd be dribbling down the court in the fast break. He wouldn't stop to hold the ball to make a pass. He'd hit it with two fingers. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Or just with the touch passes. Like, there's a famous goal where Mario Lemieux in hockey, he doesn't get an assist, but he creates a play by letting a pass from someone else go through his legs to end up on the stick of a player who has a better shot at the net, and it goes, Lemieux, crazy play, no assist. Bird would almost have these like assists where it seems like he scarcely touched the ball because he wouldn't formally catch the ball. And you'd think that people, because everyone copies someone else, someone starts doing something, someone, I'm Michael Jordan, the whole foul line thing, but that was all done before. But I've never seen anyone have that percussive relationship with the ball that Bird did. The hand-eye coordination to do that is mind-boggling to me.
Well, and that team had what I loved about them, obviously Bird and the Big Three, but there's so many terrific role players on that team, from Tony Archibald to, you know, Gerald Henderson, Chris Ford, ML Carr, Cedric Maxwell, and even guys like Terry Durod, who just passed away recently, Rick Roby. It seemed like all those guys would have a moment during the course of that season when they would come up with a big play or a big game when they needed it most.
And Archibald gets the lone title of his career. And you think, like, if you just hear that name in Celtics lore, you think there are, like, multiple titles. But that's really going to be it. And it wasn't his team at that point. But I think that's one of the things about the best teams is you go through the different sports. Yes, there are the superstars, but those guys who are the B-plus, B players, like, that's what made the Patriots so good in 03, 04, is, of course, they had the future Hall of Famers, but so many guys were just plus players. And the Islanders of the early 1980s, yes, there's Bossy and there's Trottier and Potvin and everything, but then you have these really solid, like, Ken Morrow type of guys, John Tinelli, Bob Nystrom type of guys. There's just so much depth of guys who could have been frontline guys on other teams. And I think that 80-81 Celtics team during this period of transition of eras, because it would seem to me that you wouldn't expect to be winning if you were that team. You don't really expect to take the title that year. I think it was kind of like, oh, we're a few years early type of deal. So it was almost like a bonus title in the way that, like, the Patriots 2018 season was a bonus title at the end that you didn't expect. And then it spearheaded this run that culminated in, of course, the 85-86 season when you have the Big Three left and all those other players they're gone by then.
And Bill Fitch would have a Hall of Fame career, but when he got to Boston, yeah, he had struggled through a lot of pretty mediocre seasons as head coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers, and I don't know how much was expected of Fitch, but, you know, he ran off with three straight seasons of 60-plus wins in the regular season.
Yeah, they were dominant, and I think, like, if you look at that era, and it's not even just like, oh, things from back then were better, it was just such a tough league. And it wasn't a popular league yet. It was on its way to that with the whole ascent of Bird and Magic. But it just seems when you look at, like, you go to the basketball reference page and you look at all the teams, it's like, is there anyone who is not, like, laden with Hall of Famers? Like, this must have been brutal every night. The schedule. You have things that, too, like, people, I feel like they think of him more as an ABA player now. But you had, like, prime middle of his career, Dr. J, who just was, like, a beast at the time. He's like the Kevin Durant of his age. And so for them to run off those seasons like that and to have this early title and then be in contention for the title and have to do what they did against the Lakers and maybe not achieve as much as they should have. But I think for a season when you couldn't have had the expectation of, like, okay, we're going to win it this year. We're one of the few contenders. I think it speaks volumes.
Go to Jazz Times and check out Colin's piece on the Billie Holiday documentary. You can go to thelondonmagazine.org and read his wonderful fiction, It Was Night. Of course, if you haven't yet, get your hands on a copy of Meathead's Say the Realest Things, a satirical short history. Wait a second, I'm going to get it wrong. A satirical short novel of the last bro, right? Did I get it right that time?
Yeah, Zulu Redemption.
Thank you. Thank you so much there, Colin Fleming. Every week here on Downtown. Thank you, sir. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Sounds good.
Colin Fleming.